The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 16, Vault Number 76. The trip to London went reasonably well. Harry thought he might have shrunk a size number in his waist, so tight was Hermione clinging to him, but otherwise she took it really well, and after an hour she stopped singing, "Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, think happy thoughts, everything's happy thoughts, we're gonna die." Harry and Draco made a point of flying smoothly, and perhaps slower than if they had been by themselves. They were once again grabbing each other's brooms, which, in addition to being a very funny sentence, now it made for a less bumpy flight. The brooms were a bit different, so it was better to fly this way. Harry's Moonrider was bigger, hence why Hermione rode with him, whereas Draco's old Comet 460 wasn't very good with high altitude or strong winds, but it had better maneuverability. It also had the name Johnson engraved on the handle. Harry had to take 5 minutes for himself after he saw that. In the end, they arrived to Diagon Alley a bit after 10 in the morning. This was a bit late for what they were planning. One would think they should have been there long before the bank opened, but usually at this time they were just finishing breakfast, and sometimes they were just starting because they saw no reason to wake up early. Harry couldn't stop thinking of how Angelina and Alicia and the twins used to complain when Oliver made them get up before 9 for Quidditch training. In any case, they were there, and they had hidden the brooms in an alley, and Harry was standing there, eyes closed and arms extended, mumbling to himself like a druid or a priest, one that kept repeating that he was an alien, a legal alien, in the city of New York. They were shrouded in a glamour that would make them unremarkable. They were ready to enter Gringotts. They went in, saw Bellatrix in the foyer, and went out again.
"Let's just wait until she's done," said Harry. "We'll keep an eye out in case we see her leave with a package."
"Shouldn't we try to go closer and listen to what she says?"
That was Hermione, of course. She had never let some little panic stop her while she was moving forward in life.
"I would rather eat glass," said Draco in utter and honest seriousness.
Just because Hermione took it worse didn't mean Bella didn't have an effect on the others. It wasn't just them. She tended to have that effect on people who weren't interested in having sex with her. More interesting were the cases when both reactions collided. Harry wanted to wait by the cafe on the corner, but they didn't have any money, and it would be incredibly weird to pay for 3 cups of tea with a check. They were forced to wait standing around, and it was not miserable. Miserable was too big a word, but it was not nice. It was cold and wet and windy, and they all wished they could have waited inside, drinking some hot and delicious beverage. Draco produced a big poster of Puddlemere United that, for some unfathomable reason, he had taken with him. He started to fold it carefully in many pieces, and when he was done and he unfolded it, holding it with both hands, it looked like he was studying a map, and that guaranteed that the few people that were ambling around gave them a wide berth, lest they asked them for directions. Bella didn't stay much longer in the bank, but it felt far too long. The weather was horrible. She was dressed nicely, velvet in her skirts, rubies in her ears, a nice big cloak with embroidery in the cuffs and the hem. The only thing ugly about Bella was her character and her soul. She didn't seem to be carrying anything other than her wand. She didn't stay long. She walked down the white marble stairs, and as she reached the bottom and stood just 10 steps from them, she apparated away. They didn't move. They almost felt like she would be there if they turned around, but no, she was really gone. It's not as if she had looked at them, and she hadn't recognized them. She simply hadn't looked at all. Just like yesterday, nobody thought to question Murphy of what she might have heard. She was too high and powerful to even remember there was a floor and people living on there. The next part would be more difficult.
Harry Potter, I wish to access my vault.
Hermione was at his right, with her needle pointing at the goblin, Zertuk, who read the little plaque. Draco was on his left, and with his back to them, ready to fight everyone in the bank if things went awry.
"Number 687, said the goblin, who seemed unaware that Harry Potter was, well, Harry Potter, undesirable number one. "Press your palm or touch your wand here, sir."
He pushed a golden orb towards Harry without raising his eyes from whatever he was looking at behind the counter. Harry touched it gingerly with the end of his wand. Better to lose the wand than having his hand glued to the orb if this was a trap, but it wasn't. The orb emitted one single pulse of light, and Sirtuk nodded in satisfaction.
"Will you be going alone, sir?"
No, they're coming with me.
"Follow me, then."
Sirius had told them that goblins didn't seem to care at all about human affairs, but they really hadn't thought it would be to this degree. Between this and the absurdly long wait of yesterday, it felt as if Harry had become completely irrelevant to the war. If that were true, how glad his parents would be. Sirtuk took them to the main door and to the tracks with the little carts. It was a bit of a tight fit, but at least being pressed together avoided any jostling as the cart took corners at full speed.
"I hate this," murmured Hermione after the third quick turn in less than a minute.
Harry would have said something if he weren't completely focused on keeping his glasses on his face. Draco, too, had his mouth closed tight and a look of concentration. The cart came to a halt abruptly, and Harry felt as if his stomach had climbed up into his lungs.
"Vote 687, called Sirtuk, jumping down.
Thank you,
they said as they got to the platform and slowly shook their organs back into place. The goblin, of course, seemed to be perfectly composed and not even a little bit shaken.
We'll probably be down here for a while, said Harry.
He was so shaken by the trip that he managed to cover the lie quite well.
No need for you to hang around. We'll call you.
Of course, sir,
Sirtuk said as pleasantly as a goblin could be. Harry opened the door to his vault with barely shaking hands, and they all got in. Harry noticed almost absent-mindedly how much gold there was there. The time Hagrid took him, he hadn't cared at all if it didn't serve him to buy his dad's freedom, and most of the rest of the time someone else took the money for him. Perhaps they feared that Harry would refuse to step back out of the vault. Harry would be the first to admit that he might have tried it if given the chance. So he hadn't paid much attention to the gold, and even now he wasn't really impressed in it, but this time he couldn't help really noticing it. There were piles and piles of it. Enough, he thought, that he could buy a house. Enough to get his old house back and add a few rooms, and wasn't that a nice thought? A house where Remus and Severus and Sirius and Draco and he could all live after the war. It would have to be a big house because, even in his fantasies, Harry could see that Sirius and Severus were a difficult combination, but most importantly, it was a thought for after. Harry didn't have many thoughts for that time. He had a to-do list of things he wanted to do if he managed to both win and survive the war. Get back Regulus's body, find the family of James the Muggle, get something nice for Dobby, Creature, and Murphy. But he didn't have many thoughts for himself. Almost as if he still wasn't sure he would make it. And now look at that, a fully formed thought of what his life could be. Almost as if he had started dreaming while he wasn't looking. He even knew the tone of yellow he wanted for the living room and the lovely dark blue and silver or white that he would have in his and Draco's bed. His hand found Draco's and he squeezed.
"Since we're here, we could take some money with us," said Hermione, ever practical.
"Oh!" Harry had maybe forgotten about that. Yes, he was an adult and could take his own money now. That meant that the next stakeout could be indoors in a warm coffee shop.
Yes, absolutely. Let's all take some.
They took the money and even made sure to include some canuts and sickles so they would have small change. Paying for a cup of tea with a galleon drew unnecessary attention. Maybe not if you were a Malfoy, but being a Malfoy was also unnecessary attention. This also served to pass the time a little bit and make sure that by the time they opened the door, the goblin, what was his name, Sefer, were well out of hearing. His name was Sirtuk, and he hadn't gone anywhere. He was standing there next to the cart and looking straight at them in a sick parody of Murphy.
"On second thought," said Draco, "we will stay here for the next 8 hours. I'm not sure we counted all the sickles. Carry on, sir. No need to wait for us."
"Of course, sir."
Sirtuk nodded his head. They closed the door and waited anxiously for the sound of the cart leaving, which of course didn't come, and didn't come, and didn't come.
"You're still there, aren't you?"
called Harry less than an hour later. It seemed like they had exhausted all their patience yesterday, and the idea of waiting to outbore a goblin was unbearable.
"Yes, sir,"
came Sirtuk's voice, muffled by the heavy door.
"Would you mind leaving?"
"Of course, sir."
"You didn't leave?"
"No, sir."
"Draco, you better think of something."
"Me?"
Draco looked up from the castle he was building out of galleons. He was using the sickles to make the water in the moat.
"Certainly not us," said Harry, and he couldn't know. None of them could. But in that moment he sounded just as his father. Just as when James got on McGonagall's or Moody's nerves by being insanely lucky and brave.
"I just offered him a cupcake, and Hermione wants to Petrificus Totalis him. I'm not sure that it'll work. They say Professor Flitwick is less than 1/4 goblin, and I've seen him shake lots of foul charms in class."
Hermione, who was eating the rejected cupcake, nodded her head. Neville had accidentally hit Flitwick many times, and he always took it in stride.
"Well..." Draco scrubbed his face with both hands. They could always try to dig a tunnel from this vault to another one.
Draco's plan worked for 6 whole minutes, which was a pathetically short time for what they wanted to do. They hadn't even left the 600s yet. It was, however, a record in the history of Gringotts. People hardly got minutes into a break-in before being stopped with strength and usually lasting consequences like death or horrible disfiguration. It was quite embarrassing that it had worked at all. Draco had lured Zertuk in by loudly and very obnoxiously insisting that there were 3 canuts missing from the vault. As soon as the goblin had stepped in, he had turned on his heels and slammed the door behind them, leaving the goblin trapped inside.
"Go!"
he had yelled, flushed with excitement. The obvious next step was to get in the cart and drive it to Vault 76, except by now they were all too realistic and knew that most likely they wouldn't even get it to run, and if they did, they would smash against the first corner they found, and even if by some miracle they avoided certain death against a wall, they would still get lost and not know how to brake. So they bypassed the cart, kicking it down, and simply started running along the tracks. During those 6 minutes, Zertuk dragged his finger across the lock to open the vault's door, righted the upturned cart, got inside, waited to hear in which direction they had gone, and started the cart to go get them.
"Will you get in, sir?"
So it was very embarrassing for the goblins, because they prided themselves on the security of the bank, but by the way Zertuk spoke, they were also quite embarrassed.
"We all know where to go, and he can't chase the 3 of us at the same time," said Draco, already bending his knees in preparation. In his first year, he had been terrified at the notion of being at night in the Forbidden Forest, and now he was suggesting a full-on run through Gringotts.
Zertuk extended an arm with a long, bony hand and grabbed Harry's arm with an iron grip. Harry wished they would still try Draco's suggestion. It was very smart, and he could probably hold Zertuk up long enough to give them a decent head start. But of course it was not going to happen, and Zertuk knew it very well. They were not leaving without Harry. They were not getting back in the cart, either. They stood there in the half-darkness of the tunnel. It was surprisingly warm for an underground place, and the air felt stiff and dense. The moment was incredibly awkward, and Zertuk seemed willing to ride it through.
"Look," said Harry. He was starting to lose sensation in his hand. The goblin's grip was really strong. "I realize we've put you in a difficult position, and I apologize, but we are on a very important mission."
"Of course, sir,"
said the goblin with the same damned neutral pleasantness of the last 2 hours. Draco chortled on an indignant squeak, and only at the last second realized that Zertuk had said it with that intention, hoping that Draco would jump within grabbing reach. The goblin had a perfect resting face, but there was something like amusement and wickedness in his eyes.
"I know this is quite out of bounds, but we are dealing with an exceptional situation," Harry went on.
"Of course, sir. Now get in the cart."
"Zertuk, please!"
Draco had his full attention on him, and an earnest voice, and he was just so pure and good, here with borrowed clothes and a bit of soot on his cheeks.
"It's not for me. It's to help stop the unholy terror that is thee."
"No."
"No?"
Draco was honestly surprised.
But don't you want to see him fall?" asked Harry.
"Think about how he treats your race,"
said Hermione, who had been subtly circling them. Zertuk shrugged, his hand still holding fast to Harry.
"Business has been good."
It had been pretty good. There had been quite a lot of movements, and the goblins charged a fee for every transaction. McNair had quickly become insultingly rich, but they had gotten a nice share of it. Only, of course, the bank had stopped being completely under goblin management. They had gone back to how things were 400 years ago, after that war the wizards never talked about, when they also imposed a human manager. For a while it had seemed as if Malfoy, that Malfoy, not this weird wand-snapping version, would be the new manager, and the goblins had been sort of satisfied with it. Malfoy had a passing knowledge of finances, which is not something that could be said of most wizards. However, in the end, he had kept his legwork assignment, tasked with finding and capturing the resistance members, and Gringotts had gotten Tarquino Rendles. Whether Rendles knew anything about finances or not soon became irrelevant, since he seemed more interested in waiving all fees to Death Eaters and alike. So now Gringotts wasn't making as much of a profit, and they had a human wizard manager, and if it weren't for all the hassle of moving, they would have emptied all the vaults and left via the underground tunnels to the branch of the bank in Geneva. They might have some people assigned to calculating the cost of such a move. It would be a difficult decision, though. Gringotts's reputation was a valuable asset that they didn't want to put in jeopardy. This was part of the reason why they usually tried to stay away from human politics. The other being that they just didn't like humans. Some humans, however, were acceptable, still grossly inclined to hyperbole and convinced that the world revolved around them and that only their stories mattered, yet willing to try a new script once in a while. Goblins didn't like deviation from rules, but they appreciated it in others.
"Is it true?"
Zertuk asked, looking at Draco. "I have no idea what you're talking about. But as a Malfoy and a Slytherin, I can tell you it probably isn't."
"They say that you took 7 wands, and that you gave them to 7 goblins.
Zedek's voice did something then, abandoning the formal and professional drone. "Oh, that!" Draco didn't hesitate. Draco had spent many years surrounded by lies, chasing lies, eating lies, and above all, believing those lies. "That's not true." Zertuk was looking at him, and it seemed like he was very deliberately not blinking. "Harry took, what was it, 3? No, 2, and Hermione took 3. I didn't pick any, although if you're speaking of power claims on account of having bettered the owner in a duel, then I think I get 1. Not sure about that other guy, but we all hexed him. But I did give one of them to Griphook and made sure to choose one that would suit him." Zertuk looked at him some more. After 30 seconds, he blinked. It was a very slow blink.
"On account of that, I think I won't be making an arrest for attempted theft, and therefore you won't be handed to human authorities. I do have to ask you to leave, however."
His voice was back to business mode, but there was something, a crinkle in the corner of his eyes, a glimmer there, that said that perhaps he had heard the story just as it was. Goblins didn't like metaphors or exaggeration, and Zertuk approved both of Draco's unheard-of gift in the form of a wand and of his unusual truthfulness. "Thank you," said Harry, already thinking of how they could convince Bella to take the cup home and steal it from there. "That's very nice." He was opening and closing his hand in a fist to get some blood circulation. "And not applicable." Zertuk's hand closed painfully on Harry's arm, but it was probably more due to surprise than anything. He turned to look at Hermione with curiosity and not a little bit of appalment. Who was this creature who dared fight with a goblin?
"You don't agree, miss?"
he said softly and full of vitriol, but nothing they hadn't heard 10 times stronger with Severus.
"No, sir,"
Hermione answered, straightening her back.
"I do appreciate the gesture, and I'm more for bigger interspecies cooperation."
Harry smiled proudly at that.
"But you say our arrest would be for attempted theft, while that has never been our intention."
It would have been enough if Zertuk hadn't said anything and let the situation speak for itself. There they were in the middle of a dark corridor, having run from Harry's vault after slamming the door behind him. However, Zertuk also felt the need to widen his eyes a little bit. His shoulders did something weird, almost as if he were restraining a bigger movement, a big extension of the arms, most likely accompanied by a loud, "Come on."
"I realize you have found us under suspicious circumstances, but the truth is we never intended to unlawfully subtract any treasure deposited in the bank."
By then, Zertuk's grip had loosened a little bit, enough that Harry could feel the blood flowing again. Under the faint light reflected on the walls, he could see Draco smiling like a maniac. In that moment, he looked a lot like Sirius Black.
No? Offered Zertuk.
No. But I will admit to wanting to cause some lasting damage. That, however, should only account to vandalism, not theft. Zertuk still wasn't convinced, but he certainly was closer to their side, so not only did he not arrest them, but he also didn't send them out of the bank, and instead decided to take them to Vault 712, which was nearby and unused, and so it had become a secret lounge room for employees.
The problem is trespassing, Zertuk said as he nursed in his hand a cup with some foul-smelling beverage. We simply cannot allow you to get access to the vault.
That should not be a problem, said Fleur. The lounge was really secret, so much so that most of the ground-level employees didn't know about it. When they arrived there, the room had been empty except for Bill and Fleur, who were enthusiastically snogging in a corner, and had taken 2 full minutes before they noticed that there was someone else in there. Bill, who was a gentleman, and Harry had been completely justified in his crush, had turned around first and sort of shielded Fleur so she could straighten her clothes and hair. And then he had actually taken a look at them.
Harry?
Bill had been dumbfounded, which was understandable because they were probably the last people he ever expected to surprise him in his secret snogging spot. Fleur, however, had been elated. She had emitted a short bird-like screech before running towards them. She had embraced Draco first, long and tight, while exclaiming something in rapid-fire French. Then she had hugged Harry equally long and tight, and Harry could feel it, all right? He could feel how damned happy she was to see them. She had stopped before Hermione in confusion, blinked, and said,
"Of course, Victor's girl."
And she had hugged her, too, even though they didn't really know each other that well, and according to her, Hermione had changed the most. Zertuk had given her a look, half threat and half humor, daring her to hug the goblin, the ugly, non-human. Fleur had hesitated just a bit before her face acquired a mischievous expression. Fleur, this Harry knew well, never backed off from a challenge. She hugged Zertuk, although not so tight, and she kissed him on both cheeks.
You know I only date Bill because you wouldn't take me?
Bill had laughed at that. He had also laughed as he hugged Draco and lifted him from the floor.
No!
And he laughed and laughed as he looked at Harry and Hermione and squeezed them together while he hugged both of them at the same time. He laughed like a man who hadn't had much reason to recently and was clinging desperately to the first piece of good news he had gotten in months. And now here they were, drinking strange tea that smelled like pomegranates and eating stale cookies as they explained how they wanted to break into Bellatrix Lestrange's private vault and smash one of her possessions.
It does not have to be them, said Fleur. It doesn't have to be you, Harry, does it not? It can be anyone.
Oh yes, anyone can do it. Horcrux breaking was an activity for everyone.
So we can open the vault ourselves and break the thing? We won't have given unlawful access to non-employees.
Fleur waved her hand, her fingers moving like the fluttering of a butterfly. Everything about her was beautiful, and today, in this dark room, in the war, it was really good to see something beautiful. Zertuk looked up to the ceiling, contemplating.
We could certainly enter the vault legitimately, he said, eyes still to the ceiling. I'm not so sure about the destruction of property.
It can be done if it becomes hazardous to the bank's personnel or the security of the vault, its contents, nearby vaults, and the building as a whole, said Bill as if he were reading from a book. I had to remove a decaying carpet at the beginning of the year that was eating the stone floor. This would be a cup that contains a piece of Tom Riddle's soul, said Draco. There was a very heavy pause. Tom Riddle is the boss of the current minister.
Ah.
Zertuk, Bill, and Fleur shared a look.
That sounds hazardous to me, said Bill. I can attest to the horrible effects a similar object had in Hogwarts.
Failing to declare such a risk goes against bank policy,
Zertuk was irked about it.
And we only store living entities or components under very special circumstances and only after favourable bank-issued report.
But if his name is Riddle,
said Fleur, her eyes jumping over all of them in quick succession.
Why would he call himself Flight of Death?
Fleur didn't seem all that shocked by the whole ripping a piece of your soul thing. She most likely thought that it was to be expected of a culture that ate red beans at breakfast.
I thought he might have meant theft, Draco said, but that doesn't make it better.
No, it does not.
Purse?
Not Purse. He's angry with the family, remember?
Oh, yes, yes.
Arthur Weasley looked down, crestfallen. I always wonder if he'd gotten him a different pet when he was younger. Arthur Weasley was currently bleeding from a cut on his forehead, and he had taken two Confundus straight to the chest. Thankfully, this time it had been Snatchers, more interested in capturing him alive and getting a reward than in killing him. Percy kneeled before him and made a quick check of the pupils and the head. His hands were trembling a little bit, and his heart was beating madly. This was, what, the sixth or seventh time he had rescued his father? It never got any easier, never was less scary, and this time he had seemed to recognize him somehow, even though Percy was wearing his usual disguise.
I am sure you did nothing wrong, he said kindly as he dabbed at his father's forehead with a handkerchief. He sighed tiredly.
Mr. Weasley, why are you here? You're not supposed to be here.
He really wasn't. How he kept sneaking from both Molly and Moody's attentive eyes was a mystery and a headache for Percy.
Tonks is in danger, mumbled Arthur as Percy helped him to get up. Colour me surprised, Percy said,
not even bothering to ask if he meant father or daughter because they were both terrible troublemakers. Who would have thought that Andromeda Black would actually be the sensible one in that family?
I'll walk you to the town. It's Muggle. I'm sure you'll love it. You can stay there until you feel better and it's safe for you to operate.
Thank you, dear. Most appreciated. It is no trouble, Mr. Weasley.
Behind remained three frogs, belly up and dead. Percy did not like killing people, and he knew that when he finally got to have a nervous breakdown, all these deaths would have a big part in it. He did not like it, yet he found it easy, which only made him dislike it even more. These men were not going to kill his father, but they would have sold him to the people who would kill him. And so it was easy for Percy to first transform them into frogs and then to kill them. He probably shouldn't have, because they most certainly were carrying important information in their pockets that was now lost. He had gotten some papers from the fourth Snatcher, the only one who managed to escape, minus two fingers, and that would have to be enough.
Bill, if it is okay to ask, what happened to your face?
Bill now sported a long, scarred line that took over his forehead, the bridge of his nose, the cheekbone, and even a bit of the skin around the eye. It was angry red and ugly, and it looked like it kept scabbing and reopening. However, Bill had always carried himself with confidence. He had good reason to, good-looking, intelligent, adequately good at sports, even if he was not a champion. So even though the scar was ugly, he made it work. His coolness had not diminished even a little bit. If the scar were not bleeding in some points, his coolness factor would have been augmented.
Oh, that, he smiled and made a gesture that Harry had seen many times in the twins. I did it myself. I thought Fleur should be the pretty one in the couple.
I am the beauty and the brains, she said quickly.
She looked at him and smiled lovingly. That girl was so in love that it looked painful.
Because it looks like werewolf injuries to me, said Harry calmly.
This, he had learned, was a bit of a taboo topic with wizards, like suggesting an embarrassing disease.
They're cursed, so they keep reopening and are very hard to heal. I know a potion, a cream more like, that helps with the scarring and some others for joint pain if you need them now.
Right, because Harry had been raised by a werewolf. Somehow, once you knew him, people kept forgetting about that. The trip down to the under 100 vaults was long, and they had had to take two carts to get there. Harry was sitting on the floor of one, squeezed between Fleur and Bill, while another goblin named Lycop drove their cart. Only goblins were allowed to do it. The way he had looked at Zertuk when he asked him to take them down had been incredible, long and hard and so very judging. But he had also agreed to do it. Merlin knew why. He had said yes even before he asked Draco if it was true that he had given a goblin three magic wands, one of gold, one of silver, and one of plain oak.
Gold is a terrible material for a wand, Draco had said, as if the goblin had suggested using a plastic straw.
But Hermione can show you a silver wand. It is a thing of beauty.
Harry seriously doubted that it actually took 10 minutes to open the vault under normal circumstances. Most likely the goblins were making up rituals to stretch the time and underline the futility of their break-in attempt. That things are took it blown over the lock. He could say that it was golden dust from the nests of the birds of prey in the Kawakar Mountains all he wanted. Harry knew it was cookie crumbs from the lounge. He wasn't going to say anything, though, just as he wasn't going to mention that he had accidentally figured out that there were at least 2 other entrances unknown to the public. This was particularly meritorious because he had been giving Bill and Fleur the cream recipe at the time. At last, after 1 murmured enchantment, Zertuk put his knobbly hands on the handle and opened the door to Vault Number 76. And to think that just an hour ago, Harry had been daydreaming about the wonderful future he could buy with his parents' money, a house with 4 bedrooms and a nice garden and a library. He had felt incredibly fortunate then. The amount of gold in Bellatrix Lestrange's vault was obscene, piles and piles of it that reached up to the ceiling. Beyond that, there were dozens of objects. 3 delicate vases of blue porcelain, a standing mirror with a golden girl and a swan holding the frame, 2 different sets of silverware, 1 silver, the other jade, a table with 2 small chests full of jewelry. There were also other darker objects, like the skull and some strange symbols engraved over it, or the box with 12 black candles tightly packed. There was a set of a silver comb and hairpins, similar to the one they had found in Grimald Place and to drive the user mad with nightmares. There was a whip with 7 red knots.
"It'll be a silver cup with the seal of Helga Hufflepuff," Hermione said as the 2 goblins stood by the entrance.
"She was here this morning," said Lycop. "Added 2 extra layers of security, no fee. And she spent 20 minutes alone in the vault."
Bill and Fleur were standing right behind the goblins with similar looks of interest and appraisal.
"I see Geminio and Flagrante," said Bill. His right hand had come to rest on Fleur's shoulders.
"The mirror has been moved," she said, her hand coming up to touch Bill's. "It is Esmerillo from the Venetian workshop. It will lock inside its surface anyone who comes close enough, but if you shine a white light in it, it won't get you."
"Do you smell rotten apples?" Bill asked.
Everyone sniffed as if on command, but they had been brought through so many places that their sense of smell was shot. There had been fire, ash, sulfur, the wet smell of underground rock, the oil in the tracks of the carts, and that damned pomegranate tea. Bill knelt on the floor and pressed his face down, peered at the floor of the vault from different angles.
"I think she might have spread Cupertine spice," he said, getting back up. "It slowly burns living skin, terribly painful. Saw plenty of it when I was studying in Egypt."
"Can't you shield yourself with a potion of pearl and, what's the word, you put it in water, canal, commadion, savon, that sapon, sapot, sopon, samisole?"
"Soap?" said Draco.
"Yes, atuel veritable treasure coco."
"That would work." Bill was smiling at her as if her frustration with the language were the most entertaining and illuminating thing in the world. "But it's too much trouble. Cupertine spice is very intense and effective, but only in dry climates. As soon as it gets wet, it decays and leaves behind that smell of rotten apples." There was an undertone to Bill's words that came to say that this was why both curse setting and curse breaking should be left to the professionals. So they got inside, Gringotts employees only, of course, and were careful not to touch anything and to shine a light into the mirror, and indeed, right behind it there was a silver cup with Hufflepuff's crest. "If she comes later on and complains, I'm telling her that any damage was caused by misapplication of Cupertine spice," said Bill as he looked around for a good place to lay the cup. He set it on the stone floor by the entrance, away from the rest of the treasure. He was wearing gloves of iron and dragon skin.
"Destroyed beyond magical repair, you said?"
Sertuk was leaning down slightly as he studied the cup with better light.
"We goblins are excellent craftsmen. We can repair almost anything."
"We used basilisk venom in the past," said Harry, "in case that helped. And a potion, but it takes days to brew it and was not very stable."
"Dumbledore used fiend fire," noted Hermione. "He could control it quite well so it wouldn't burn everything else."
The goblin's expression betrayed their doubts about how well Dumbledore could have controlled it. They muttered for a while between themselves until they reached an agreement and Lycop jumped into the cart.
"We will have to wait a little bit," informed
Sirtuk, always prepared to give the customer a pleasant experience. That was all right. Fleur and Draco were happy to chat with each other, complaining together most likely, while Bill turned his attention to Hermione and Harry. He was very, very happy to see them.
"Do you think... could you get a message to Ron?" said Hermione. "I know it's very risky, so maybe during Christmas break. Oh, and do you know who's taking care of Crookshanks? I really don't want him to get in trouble, but if he could have a look around for special objects," added Harry.
Bill's eyes turned to the color of sorrow. They had been sparkly and blue like the sky in the spring, and now suddenly they were blue like a funeral.
"I am so sorry, Hermione, Harry."
Harry was already grasping Hermione's hand, and he didn't know which one of them was grabbing tighter. "Please no, please no. It wasn't even his birthday. It was whatever month they were in. Please let Ron be all right."
"Hogwarts has been in lockdown since the beginning of the course. Absolutely no communication in or out," Bill explained. He was the eldest of 7 siblings, and he couldn't speak with 4 of them. The other 2 were miles away, Charlie in Romania and Percy in whatever world that had made him so distant.
"Snape is keeping them hostage, you know, making sure that all their families behave."
"Snape," said Harry hollowly.
He was only now feeling like his heart was beginning to beat again.
"Oh yes, he is the headmaster now. Would you believe it?"
"Oh, that bastard!" Hermione's hands jumped in Harry's grasp. To Harry's ears, she sounded full of relief and happiness, but since people weren't used to her swearing, Bill took it differently.
"I know. Rumor says that they're indoctrinating the children and making new forces for you-know-who."
"I believe it."
Harry had more experience pretending to hate or at least heavily dislike Snape. "I'm sure he's drilling them into the ground. Some people were hoping that they would be allowed out during Christmas, at least some of them. But it probably won't be the case. Don't take this wrong, I'm glad that you're all right and you made a number in the Ministry. But now they're worried in lashing back, tightening their hold on people."
"Right, right. And they have had some losses."
"Really?"
Harry lightened up. He didn't have to pretend with this.
"Do tell."
Of course, Bill, being a Gryffindor and a Weasley, didn't know much. His position was fragile enough as it was, but people talked, they always did, and information trickled down from the Ministry to the streets. It was known that there was an organized movement of resistance, the Old Order was Bill's guess, helping people get away and fighting wherever they could. And sometimes, when people were alone, when it was daylight, because nobody dared to whisper secrets in the night anymore, when they were behind closed doors and they had been with someone long enough to know they were not polyjuiced, then they might imply something. They wouldn't say it directly, nothing that could be too compromising, but they would allude to the fact that Rosier, big bad Rosier with a double-digit murder count, hadn't been seen in a long while, and neither had a few others. All dangerous Death Eaters, all in positions of influence. The second best duelist after Bella, the man who retrieved the Dark Lord's wand. Montgomery, who wasn't much as a wizard, but his family had excellent connections all around the continent. Pure-blooded Mulciber, who thought himself the next Malfoy in terms of influence and knowledge of secrets, they were all gone. Not all at once. If it were at once, it would almost be like a declaration of war. But they had vanished, and people had filled the space they left behind with words. Words about what had made them go, words about what they could know. What if, while they were all distracted, looking at Voldemort, another bigger wizard was rising somewhere else? Grindelwald had come from the continent, and in his prime he controlled a territory 5 times larger than Voldemort's. So what if someone else was preparing to rise? It would only take 1 big duel to depose Voldemort and seize his kingdom. It seemed impossible, but this hypothetical secret dark wizard had gained quite a lot of allies. The second best duelist, the man with the wand, maybe, some said, even that boy who kept disappearing.
"One," said Harry, blinking quickly to gather his ideas,
Why did they keep assuming it's a man? It could be a witch. And two, even if there were such a person, I would not go to help them. No, of course not, said Bill. We know that now, thanks to your visit to the ministry the other day, but in reality it doesn't change much. But could there really be someone? Some other lunatic who wants to take over the world? Asked Hermione. Nah, Charlie says Europe is too divided at the moment, and no one wants to take leadership because it means making yourself a target for when he decides to invade. They're already doing terrible things in Ireland. We read some, but the prophet doesn't say much. If someone is going to be the next big dark lord, interrupted Fleur suddenly, it's going to be Victor. Him and Cedric, they work very well. She smiled like a proud mama. The Triwizard Tournament had been completely insane. Seriously, they kidnapped their friends and family, and they had soon stopped being rivals and become friends. Fleur was very happy with their work. Soon after, they heard the sound of a cart approaching, and Lycop returned. Other than the fact that it was carved out of bone, the box looked like a box. It was white and about half the size of a shoebox. Lycop passed it to Bill carefully and with great ceremony, while Zertuk waved at them to indicate they should step back. There was a brief argument between Bill and Fleur over who got to hold the box. Bill won by virtue of being the tallest, which didn't make much sense. Harry didn't miss Draco's quick side eye to check if he should implement that rule in the future. There was the vault with its treasure, the cup on the floor, and Bill holding the bone box. He looked at said box and then at them.
Step farther back. No, farther. A little bit more.
There is a wall, said Hermione. In fact, there's no need to have you here to see this. You could walk down the tunnel to the corner.
William!
Said Hermione in her prefect voice. The next part wasn't pretty or heroic, and in fact should never be recorded in a story. The next part consisted of Bill bringing the box closer to the cup while at the same time attempting to put his body as far away as possible. The resulting image was similar to that of a giraffe drinking. They also got to see that Bill had very nice thighs and a wonderful ass. In fact, even though Harry did not understand a word, he was pretty sure Fleur was saying to Draco just that. She had elbowed him and smirked in a way that clearly said, "Check it out, that's my man." Then Bill opened the box, and the fires of seven different hells erupted out of it. And there was a bit of the typical yellow and orange you expect in a fire, but only in the tongues that escaped to the sides. The main flame was white and angry. There might have been a bit of a blue tint to it, but it might have also been their eyes going crazy from the sudden intensity. There was also a sound like a roar, high and uninterrupted. But below it, Harry thought he could hear that high-pitched shriek that by now was almost familiar. Bill closed the box. It was as if he had killed them, as if he had taken their hearts. The darkness and the silence were so sudden. It took them a while to regain their breaths and their sight. The air of the tunnel felt much colder now after that heat.
Well, let's see, muttered Bill.
Lumos. He was squatting now, the box on the floor with a hand on top so it wouldn't open accidentally. Unfortunately, the cup was also on the floor.
That's strange.
And then the cup collapsed, like chocolate under the sun, folding in on itself. Bill brought the cup back to Lycop, and then he levitated the silvery goop back to where they had found the cup, while Fleur shone a light against the cursed mirror.
It's just past two, said Draco, who always carried a watch with him.
Socks? No. He forgot to put those on, but he had his watch on his wrist.
Isn't that nice?
Afterwards, they got back in the carts, and they were brought to the surface. It would have been easier if they had left through one of the other doors, but Harry supposed it was too much to ask of the goblins. That was all right. He had stored that knowledge safely, just as he added another point to his to-do list. He really couldn't die now, not with that list of things to do. They all had a headache from the ride in the cart and the intense fire and the wet cold, and they were tired and hungry. Harry tried to put the glamour back and make it big, one that would really allow them to interact with people without being recognized, but he failed. That was the thing with his magic. He could do wonderful things, but only if he was in the right mood.
Well, I'm hungry, said Draco.
See if you can find a safe place to eat. I am going to go get us some sandwiches.
That said, he went into the nearest shop. He did put a hood over his hair, and since his biggest characteristic was hidden and he did not enter strutting and making taboo declarations, the witch at the counter did not recognize him at all. To be fair, even if Draco had kept his hair visible, she might have not realized it was him. This Draco was sullen, with his hands in his pockets to protect them from the cold, and ill-dressed. This was not the Draco Malfoy that lived in the collective memory. He didn't even ask what kind of cheese there was in the sandwiches when he would usually have scowled at the selection. There was a very nice, narrow alley with a dumpster in it that made for a good hiding spot. It got rejected for that same reason, since it seemed like a very obvious place to hide. Instead, they ate their sandwiches, simple ham and cheese, but way better than the ones in the Ministry, standing in front of the showcase of the Magical Menagerie. It was far less suspicious to stand there for a while looking at the animals while they ate, rather than spending more than 10 seconds near the dumpster.
"We should get our clothes," said Hermione, "warm and sturdy." "Do you have anything against that sweater?"
According to Draco, Hermione should never again dress in black because it didn't favor her. White was her color, but not pastels.
No, the sweater's great, Draco, but I could do with a better coat and a change of underwear.
It would be nice to have a shower, Draco conceded. They had tried Evanesco on themselves, but it wasn't the same.
I think we can call it a day. Find a nice place and go to sleep early.
Harry had the best ideas. He was very wise.
It's not like we have to go back to Chillington.
I like that, but there won't always be conveniently empty houses where we can hide, Draco noted, crumpling the paper of his sandwich. They stepped away from the shop and started to walk slowly but apparently purposefully down the main street of Diagon Alley. Until they found a solution, it was better to keep moving.
"Is it me, or rather an awful lot of reward posters of Draco?" asked Harry, pointing at one of the side walls that had no less than 4 copies of the same poster with Draco's face on it. "Finally, I am given the recognition I deserve as instigator of change."
"Whatever you say, number 4. Hermione was still looking around for a good place to hide, since she would rather not fly anymore or ever again.
"An awful lot," Harry went on. "When did you have time to do all the things they say? Irreverent behavior, resisting arrest, incitation to violence, and anti-government conducts?"
The list of Draco's crimes was long and oddly lacking in details. Who exactly had suffered lasting damage because of Draco? It sounded made up. But if they were going to start inventing crimes, why this sudden interest in Draco, mere number 4, when Harry and Hermione had also made a lot of trouble?
"Even in this you can see the pureblood preference," said Harry in fake disgust. "I don't know why they had to use that picture."
Draco was scowling at a picture of his 15-year-old self taken right after Umbridge created the Inquisitorial Squad. They could see Crabbe's shoulder right next to Draco's left ear.
"I look terrible. I don't like it."
"I think you look fine," said Harry, whose judgment should not be trusted in this case.
"I look sad and constipated. They did this on purpose, you know. They chose the least flattering picture they could find."
"Then it should be really hard to recognize you," Harry answered, leaning a bit against him. A touch of hip and shoulder, he sighed. He shouldn't sound so happy given how cold and windy it was.
"Come on, Draco, it's just the most recent picture they have of you," said Hermione, a voice of reason. This was why she was number 3 on the list. She threw fewer tantrums.
However, that time when she discovered Dumbledore had played her had been epic and terrifying. No wonder he had died before she got a chance to confront him.
"I could send them one," Draco muttered,
knowing that he wouldn't do it, but wishing he could. A picture in which he recognized his face, one in which he looked happy.
"I miss my children," Arthur said sadly as Percy sat in front of him with their drinks. The place was warm and it had long hours, so he could stay there for as long as needed.
"I am sure they miss you too," Percy said pleasantly. He couldn't indulge much in caffeinated drinks, so he relished each opportunity to have one.
"I wish I could see them."
Percy took his father's cup and a pen from his pocket. It had been a present from Hermione Granger years ago, and he loved it. It was a pity he could not use it in the Ministry, because it was the one single thing that made Percy's life easier.
"I'm not sure that they would be all too happy to see you at the moment," Percy said as he scribbled on the cup. "Seeing how you keep sneaking away and getting yourself in trouble, Mr. Weasley."
The twins would laugh.
That they would do, Percy agreed.
He put the pen back in his pocket and pushed the cup back to Arthur.
But I don't think the others would find it funny how you endanger yourself.
Percy, said Arthur, his eyebrows going down. He was nursing the cup between his hands without really noticing it was there.
He would frown. Never liked breaking the rules, that one. Bit of a pompous twit,
Percy said after taking a sip of his drink. He couldn't really call it coffee, it was too poor and cheap a name. This drink had mocha flavor and milk foam and cinnamon dust over it, and it was fantastic.
Merlin, how I miss him, said Arthur.
His voice was coming clearer now. When he had just been hit with the confundus, he had sounded a bit more tremorous and jittery.
I love him so much.
Percy said nothing. He stared at his father with his lips pressed in a thin line. He couldn't say when the last time was that someone had told him that they loved him. His mother had told him, for sure, but he was a quiet boy in a big family, and it was easy for those words to get lost. It might be that he hadn't heard it since he was 11 and taking the train to Hogwarts for the first time. He couldn't remember if they had said it when he got his owls. They had congratulated him, he knew that, but then his mother had said that Ron and the twins should pay more attention to him, and the twins had said their necks couldn't possibly hold a head as big as Percy's, and then his mother had scolded them and someone else had done something and they all forgot about Percy. Well, Charlie, in his second-to-last letter, Charlie had written, "You know I love you, Percy," followed by some careful lines that came to say, "I have no idea what in Helga's hell you are doing anymore." Percy thought Bill might have written to Charlie, because suddenly he was a bit more pushy and wanted to know more of Harry's thoughts. Percy was absolutely certain that the Department of Mystery was going through his post. He knew because one time, on a particularly bad day, 2 witches dead and 10 arrests, and he hadn't been able to prevent it, he had written a letter to Charlie in which he told him about how horrible he felt and how dreary it all was. Nothing more. Not a word about seeing the future and making sure Ron and Ginny were safe, yet as he signed the letter, he had a vision of his own arrest and Gibbons entering in his apartment with that same letter clutched in his left hand. He had burned it, and he had cried, and he had given a considering look to a bottle of fire whiskey that had slept in his living room until he found a place for it. All of the assistants to the minister, junior or senior, had received one. A gift, a bribe, from some gentleman who wished them well and appreciated their efforts. He had taken it because he had to, because rejecting bribes was a dangerous act, an insult to the person offering and to all those who accepted it. He had also thrown the whiskey away, full of anger at Voldemort and the world, and the fact that despite all he was doing, he couldn't even complain. He couldn't vent, he couldn't. His last letter to Charlie had been curt and firm and back to the spiel he used to give during the year Fudge went insane. He didn't expect any more letters from Charlie now, and it was a pity because he cherished them. But he should know better than to ask Percy this way. Percy was still a Gryffindor and a redhead and a Weasley, and he hadn't taken the mark on his arm, so he remained under suspicion, even if he also had quite a lot of influence. Different departments, you see. Other than the new Aurors, the branded ones, everyone was under permanent investigation.
"I have to go, Mr. Weasley," he said at last, rising from his chair. "Take care, and please do not get in so much trouble."
Percy went back to the counter and bought a lemon and poppy seed muffin for his father. He put it before him in silence, and then he left the cafe without another word. Arthur Weasley woke with a jolt. He hadn't really been asleep. He knew his eyes were open, yet he still had the sensation as if he were waking up. Slowly, he started to notice the drone of conversations around them. He was holding a very interesting tall white cup in his hands, which, on further inspection, had about 2 fingers of lukewarm coffee. What a funny little thing. The texture was incredible. It felt like paper, yet it held liquid, and he had never seen something quite like it. As he turned it in his hands, he saw there was something written on the surface. Of course, paper. "This one is on me, Mr. Weasley."
and I will buy you as many as you want if only you stop being reckless. G. Arthur stayed for a little while, looking at the people and the decor and even the menu with the same enjoyment and attention as if he were in a museum. He took one of the plastic stirrers with him before finally leaving to go face Molly and Moody. Also, regardless of what Galahad said, something had to be done about Tonks. Once again, Narcissa saw as a girl, a young woman, dragged herself across the garden. It was not as cold as the other time. She could see Alicia standing there, her feet buried in the earth and her face up to get the small rays of the sun. She did not move as Nymphadora went by her side. Alicia hardly seemed to notice anything that went on around her these days. Soon the shadow of the house would reach her spot. Soon the shadow of the house would reach her spot. Narcissa should go and get her, take her to the roses by the entrance. Alicia would get some good 3 or 4 hours of sun there. She seemed to enjoy the sun. She would make sure that the broom shed was properly locked as she went down. Burlock and Yaxley never bothered taking their brooms there. They just left them hanging wherever they dismounted. They were the kind of people who kicked their shoes against the wall as they entered their house and left them there for everyone to trip on them. It would be their fault. Theirs and Eric Avery's, who had gone down to the cells even when he was told not to. He had gone down because he wanted to rape the girl before Bella arrived and formally laid claim to her. Not even the news of the Dark Lord's gift had managed to bring Bella back from London. Supposedly she was busy with the hunt of Draco and Sirius. Narcissa thought there must be something else. The girl had fought back. She had fought back, and Narcissa wasn't sure what she had done. She was not going down to check any time soon. Maybe she had killed him, or maybe she had only injured him and left him there, but she had taken his wand. She had also gone through the library to take note of the plans laid there, and Narcissa could only admire her commitment to the mission. Most people would have just run out of there and forgotten about everything else. Maybe she would bring a book and read to Alicia, see if the words awoke her. It would be nice to sit in the sun by the roses and read. It didn't count as speaking if she was reading someone else's words. End of chapter 16. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 page as well as the Tumblr of author Andrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find the stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you will consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.